Winter thrills await at Winterfest at Nemacolin. Join the fun on Saturday, February 10th for a day of fun-fueled winter festivities like skiing and snowboarding, snow tubing, ice skating, and snow bikes. You'll be able to meet the Nemacolin Dogs Sled Team, try your hand at ice bowling, compete in the out-cold race, and finish your day with a brew by the fire at the peak. A winter of wonders waiting for you at Nemacolin's Winterfest. Experiences are for overnight guests and members. For more information, visit nemacolin.com.
Welcome to Conversation With.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Great to be here.
If you were going to be reincarnated, would you still choose to be a jazz musician, or would you choose something simpler, like, let's say, being a barista?
Well, the notion of being a barista is quite romantic, but I do feel that, you know, that I've had a wonderful life and I'm leading a wonderful life as a musician, and I have so much to do that I would want to come back and still be a jazz musician the next time around.
Well, you make it sound very nice, but actually there have been some pretty tough times as a jazz musician. Jazz is not exactly a sector that tons of people listen to. It's considered quite intellectual, possibly sometimes even elite. Why choose this rather tough road?
Well, of course, it's been a long road. It's been 42 years now that I've been doing this. And during this time, of course, I have the Hunger Years and the Hunger Games. And I also have to say it's a feast or famine sort of existence, being a jazz musician. But overall, when I look back, I think I've been very blessed. And I now have reached a stage where, you know, the struggle is not painful anymore. The struggle is more about trying to create good music and not so much worry about, you know, what I need for sustenance and so on. Of course, you know, you learn to be, as a musician, you come to a point where you learn to realize that your joy comes from making music and not from things that are expensive, like that I used to like when I was younger.
Well, you talk about going through these hunger years when you were in your 20s. You had to set up a company that did commercial jingles like Coca-Cola, Nescafe, KFC. I believe you actually even did a jingle which was rather successful for a pimple cream.
Yes. I actually started off my jingle career in 1981 doing two pimple creams in succession. So I thought I was going to just do nothing but pimple creams. But anyway, I was lucky to get all those other clients that came to me to do their jingles. But, you know, it wasn't a difficult time in that, although it was a lot of hard work, I worked all day in the studio and then went and played my gigs all night and went back after that to mix the jingle I recorded in the day and only got to sleep at 3 or 4 in the morning and back in the office the next day at 10 or 11. I didn't do very well. I mean, jingles was very lucrative. I held 75% of the market at the time until 1991. So you know, it was actually those were not the Hunger Games. It was the Sleepy Games.
I'm terribly impressed. Can I hear, though, one of the pimple cream jingles? Do you still have it in your head
no,
that you
I'm
can hum?
Not. You know, I've done 700 of those. You know, so some of them have actually won awards in London and New York. But those ones I actually forgot completely already.
What about the Coke one?
Well, the Coke one wasn't an original. I was actually asked to rearrange and re-record it because at that time there was a rule that you couldn't use superlatives. So you couldn't say the biggest taste you'll ever find. So I had to re-record with words that were not superlatives. So I had to change the lyrics to you'll ever find, you know, so that the superlatives weren't there. There was just a rule in advertising back then. But it was still a lot of fun to dissect and completely tear apart the original commercial and re-record it, reconstitute it, and make it sound as good as the American original version.
So do you feel sometimes that there's a tension between this commercial push for music, which in fact we could argue you see tremendously with pop music now, where all of it's about the packaging, and sometimes you might even argue more about the packaging than the song itself?
I think the thing that comes through, no matter how much the packaging is and the hype is the intent of the artist and the composer. And intent in whatever field you are in really is the thing that comes through. And when people can feel your genuine intent and whether they agree with it or not, if they like it, if aesthetically it's what they want to listen to, they will feel attracted to come and listen or buy your idea or buy your music or buy your piece of art. And so I think it's the key things, no matter how much hype there is, that the artist is true and sincere and have artistic integrity.
Even if, let's say, for example, you know, the recording house, production company comes to you and says, well, you mean, Jeremy, we need to jazz you up. I mean, you're this friendly looking man, you smile, you're obviously extremely jovial, but we need you to be more hip. We need you to be more, you know, edgy. What would you do?
Well, after having done it for 42 years and still being reasonably successful, I guess I have my parameters. I'm open to people's suggestions. If I'm asked to, for example, collaborate with a rap artist, you know, if I like the rap artist, then it doesn't really matter. And I see the intent and integrity and the belief that he or she has in this particular art, and I find some kind of synergy between what he or she does and what I do, I would gladly do it, you know. So I'm not close to ideas of doing things and collaborating and so on. But if I don't really like the particular person's music or his art, or then maybe I might not say yes for that reason and find some polite way to say no.
Is there a particular genre of music that you would absolutely not go towards? And obviously, you know, you wouldn't do any country and western, or I don't know. Is there something that you think, no, that's lame, I'm not going to do that?
Well, country and western is great because it's two kinds of music, right? Country and western. So you get two for the price of one, right? So, but you know, I would absolutely, in fact, not unbeknownst to many people, the first album I ever recorded on in 1977 was Matthew and the Mandarins, a country album. And I actually love country music. And a lot of people don't realize that one of my greatest influences was the country pianist Floyd Kramer. And actually his style finds his way into my playing even now. So, you know, I actually do not dislike country and western. I like it very much.
When you have a young jazz musician come to you now, a young Asian jazz musician, and they say, you know, please, Jeremy, would you listen to this piece? And you listen to it, and you don't like it. Because it's easy to deal with people when they are very talented. But what do you do with people who would like to do jazz, but obviously don't have the talent? What do you say to them?
Well, it's easy to hear whether or not the person has the propensity to become a good jazz artist. And it's very hard to tell someone not to do it. And then one or two people I've actually told, and I won't mention names, went on to have some very, very successful careers in an opposite, in an alternative creative field where they have excelled, you know. I think in my whole career, I've only said twice to people, you really shouldn't do this. You should maybe do something else in music because I see that they have a skill and a talent. Or I've said, you know, maybe not music as your main focus. But generally, I don't. And also, sometimes people sound horrible, but you can see something. You know that if they worked hard and they kept at it, that they will actually become good. And so then I would try to encourage and tell them not to give up.
Okay, so you're not a dream crusher.
Yeah, I hope I haven't crushed anyone's dreams.
What about the toughest judges of all, and that is the audience? What has your experience been in terms of, you know, who have been really tough audiences?
Well, generally speaking, in the beginning, I used to, you know, bemoan the fact that I didn't get enough attention or adulation or you know, just respect from the audience. But through the years, I mean, now, as I said, having done this for more than four decades, generally speaking, the people who love to come and hear me play and so on and so forth have been very nice and very supportive.
Okay, so it's a self-selection process.
Yes.
So you haven't had audiences where they seem cold or where they really don't respond to you?
Well, sometimes it's my fault. Like, for example, no one told me once. I used to tell jokes a lot during my shows. I don't do it very much anymore. A little bit. Now I banter and people find it funny. It's more than when I used to actually try and tell actual jokes. But there was one time no one told me before I went on stage. I came from one gig to another that the entire audience was Japanese travel agents who didn't understand English. So I went on stage and I told my, and all my jokes just fell flat. I just said, I think I'll just play.
Well, they were completely stone-faced. Yeah, they didn't know what you were talking about.
They
didn't understand.
Yeah, they didn't speak English. It was very embarrassing.
Being a musician is tough. It's obviously not an easy job to do. Do you feel that you would discourage people and say, okay, you know, there are other paths to take than being a musician? There can be other means of being creative than the one that you have chosen if a young person wanted to try to be a musician?
Well, now it's so hard. I actually do discourage people from wanting to become a professional musician. But I do say that you do not have to be a professional musician to play music or create music at a professional level. And nowadays, you know, I have friends, for example, who are doctors and play music, compose music as good as any professional musician. And so, you know, when parents say you should have something to fall back on, in the old days, I used to resent people saying that, but now I don't, because it becomes almost impossible to make a living as a musician. There are no more residencies at hotels that I had in the first half of my career. You know, you can't really sell records anymore. In fact, I try and give a CD to a radio DJ and say, I'm sorry, I don't even have a CD player. They ask me, can you send me the files to play on air? And so it's become very, very difficult. And then also things like streaming, you know, which I sometimes cruelly call institutionalized piracy, you don't make any money as well, only from the occasional live gig. So I would say, if you love music, you love art, you know, find a way to find... You know, I always think there's two things. You got to have your job or your work. To me, your work is your life's mission, whatever it is you do. And your job is what you do to earn a living. So my work could be helping out at the Salvation Army over the weekend. And my job could be taxi driver Monday to Friday to pay my bills. So similarly with music, if you can't actually make, if your music can't be a job and overlap, then do something else that allows you to pay your bills, look after your family, send your kid to college, and then find and make sure you're really passionate to be disciplined enough to give yourself time to train and practice and compose and write and then occasionally perform, of course.
So do you think technology has killed music and killed, so to say, the musician to some degree?
No, I think on many levels, what we've found now is that not just in music, things are becoming cheaper and cheaper to access. I mean, like, you know, you look at all the disruptive things, and this disruption is here to stay, whether you like it or not. So you can either, you know, if you're a bridle maker for horses for carriages, when they didn't have carriages anymore, so what? You have tens and thousands, not hundreds of thousands of people who are out of work. But things change. And so we have to accept it, because if we fight it, we find ourselves really left by the sidelines. So there is a way. It doesn't mean you have to give up your craft. Doesn't mean you have to give up your love and your passion. You got to see. Like in New York, this has been happening for a long time. Someone acts on a Broadway play, but in between plays, they're working tables. No shame, nothing. They have to pay the bills. Then they get a gig, right? They get a part on a off-Broadway, a Broadway play. And then they enjoy it for 6 months that the thing runs. They make a lot of money, save some money. And then, you know, they do that and they have no qualms about it at all.
But the dream always is to make money from the thing that you love. And yeah, not to have the other bit, so to say, which is the sweat bit.
So this may come. For example, I've always had this actually as well, where I have my job. I mean, not to sound too unromantic about my jingle writing, but my jingle writing was my job. Playing jazz is my work. It's my life mission, my passion. So then when I, you know, then or playing, for example, I used to joke that the way I make the most money is actually, you know, being paid stupid amounts of money to have my name on an invitation card for an event, to then be ignored for 2 hours. But that allows me to go and play at this very beautiful jazz gig to 100 people who are giving me pin drop silence attention, right? But the only way I can do that is because I've done these other gigs where people ignore me for 2 hours. So, you know, it's a balance. Life is balance.
If you were to make an estimate, how much of jazz is perspiration and how much is inspiration?
Well, the thing about it is, when sometimes people look at me or other jazz musicians play, they say, wow, you make it look so effortless. But, you know, it takes tens and tens of thousands of hours of effort to make it look effortless.
So a lot of perspiration.
Yes, absolutely.
So do you still do your scales and arpeggios? I mean, do you have to still practice?
Yes, I have a sort of a maintenance regime. It's about 90 minutes. And my first third is actually doing boring scales, with the exercises and etudes, and the first half an hour. And sometimes it's so boring because really it's like running on the beach for the boxer before he even goes to the gym. So I'm doing that. I'm very athletic, but only on my fingers. So then, you know, you sort of go up and down the piano. And in fact, it's so mundane. Sometimes I'll actually read the newspaper, you know, with my iPad while I'm doing my, You know, unless I'm working in some new... Other than that, it's just basically working and strengthening so that, you know, after 3 days as a pianist, your hands can actually start to atrophy. Just 3 days. So, you know, they always say that if one day you don't practice, you know. Second day you don't practice, you know, the press will know. Third day you don't practice, your fans will know. So really, it's unfortunately, it's something you just can't stop doing. And then the second third of the practice, I would work on tunes that I'm working for a particular concert. And I have this part of my practice called facing my demons, where until today, there may be things that I don't do well, and I'm afraid, I say I don't like it, but not because I don't like it, because I don't know how to do it. And I'll spend a part of my practice facing my musical demons.
You sound like a very hardworking, virtuous person. You've gone through, though, coming back to this technology issue, seeing technology going from tape recorders to, you know, CDs, and now to streaming. Has this made a difference to how you produce music and how you compose?
Well, of course, the technology is there nowadays to actually have a nice bedroom studio. I mean, you can actually have in a room in your house a studio that maybe 30 years ago you would have had to spend millions of dollars on now, and you can spend $10,000-$15,000 with computers and software plugins and so on and actually get similar quality. But I think nothing takes away from being in a recording studio with other musicians. After all, how much fun is it to, even as a kid, to play on your own, right? You want to play with your musician playmate. So definitely, I love being in the studio, still recording with live musicians, all playing at the same time, at a skill level high enough that we just have to do one or two takes before we've actually got it. So my last 7 or 8 albums actually were all recorded, everyone in the studio at the same time, maybe a few dubs later, but largely, two-thirds, maybe more than that, was recorded with live musicians all in the same room.
Well, what do you think of these YouTube sensations then, these supposed, you know, musicians who are able to just do it, as you say, from their bedroom?
Yes.
Do you think that that's a bit of a scam?
Well,
or
there's
just
some
cute,
really...
but doesn't have much depth.
I think there's some great musicians that use YouTube now as the channel and the platform to become heard and seen around the world. And the beautiful thing about YouTube is that, for example, before I wanted to learn a particular music software, I would have either have to buy a book or go and take a one-week course to learn it. But now I just stay at home and put on the YouTube, and there's like free courses like on how to do something I want to learn. So I think the proliferation of wonderful musicians actually brought about, that's the good side of this technology, that they've actually democratized and made available the knowledge that was previously only known or available to the very few is now available to everyone who wants to seek for it.
If we look at the number of songs downloaded, and if we look at Spotify, for example, they argue that hip-hop is the most listened to genre. Do you worry that jazz is too elitist?
I don't think so. I mean, jazz had very, very humble beginnings. It was played in the saloons, actually even in the whorehouses back in New Orleans, you know. And Jelly Roll Morton actually was a pianist in a bordello, you know, so a bar downstairs in a saloon like you see in the Westerns, you know. And so it really was the music not of the rich people, it was the poor people, music that came from the struggle of slavery. The Black American, Afro-American people actually sing the blues at first, right? And then later on it evolved into being jazz. And of course, because the elite may have taken it and on as a particular art form that they want to attach themselves to. So maybe there's the feeling that it does belong to the elite to a certain degree. But I think there are many people who love jazz who are not the elite. Obviously, don't have a lot of money. I call them the one coke wonders. They come to the gig and they watch me play. They buy one coke and sit on it all night. So obviously, they're not one of the elite.
But you've played for even Barack Obama. You know, it has now, jazz has this sort of cachet that it's meant for, you know, possibly intellectual and even possibly only older people. How do you break out of that so that young people will listen to jazz too?
Well, the way I'm doing it is a couple of years ago, I started the Jazz Association of Singapore, which has become a charity in Singapore. And really, one of our ambitions, and in fact, one of the tasks given to us by our patron, Professor Tommy Koh, is bring jazz to the masses, bring jazz to every corner of the island, and make sure that people of all walks of life, not just the elite, will enjoy jazz. And so that's one of the missions that we have at the Jazz Association, and that's what we're trying to do now, where we go out to community centres, I do talks. I gave talks to schools in the 80s and 90s and reached out to 100,000 school children, who many of whom are now jazz fans. Some of them actually got married after meeting school and coming to my talks or my performances. They come up to me and explain, hey, we met when we were students and we love jazz now. And so that's wonderful. And I think that's what I want to do now with my team, to go out and actually talk about jazz, play, and let people understand the joy of jazz. And so that jazz will become something that's easily found all over, not just for the elite, not just in the center of the city.
If you could be reincarnated as an instrument, what would it be?
Oh, wow. I told you before the interview that it's hard to ask a Gemini that kind of question, because we don't have the definitive answer for a lot of it, you know. I think probably a cello. I just love the tone of the cello and just the beautiful emotive music that comes out of it.
Jeremy, if you could name a song, a piece of music that you think a person who doesn't know much about jazz, who doesn't know much about music, ought to listen to kind of reel them into this music world, what would that piece of music be?
Well, my favourite piece of music, and it's not necessarily just for jazz people, but anybody, is the song Smile by Charlie Chaplin. I mean, it's such a beautiful tune and it brightens up every day, right? I mean, it goes, smile though your heart is aching.
Smile even though it's breaking.
You see? Even you know it.
You're right. It's a lovely piece. It's a really lovely song. But why is it so special?
Well, you know, it's great because it lifts you up even on the darkest day. And the second thing about it is, you know, actually, Charlie Chaplin is supposed to have been in a very, very depressed mode when he wrote that song. And I think he wrote it to lift himself up and also others, you know. And it's got a lovely melody, a very well-constructed melody. It's just wonderful harmonies, not just the original harmonies, but the potential for great reharmonization. So it's my favourite tune.
Jeremy, thank you very much for being on Conversation With.
Thank you very much.
If you've been hurt by a truck, you can call Colombo Law 24/7 and we'll be there to make sure you're taken care of. When someone is hurt by a truck, Colombo Law is the law firm people call to get answers. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.